Some days call for some oomph to amplify your everyday look, like when you want the look of false lashes without the extra effort. Reach for Thrive Cosmetics Liquid Lash Volumizer Mascara. Or when you want all eyes on your smile, keep Empower Gloss Ultra Glossy Lip Serum in your bag. It's a burst of 24-hour hydration that smooths like a serum, shines like a gloss, and can be worn sheer or layered. You'll also look and feel your best with Thrive Cosmetics. Plus, every product is 100% vegan, cruelty-free, and made with clean, skin-loving ingredients that work with your skin, not against it. And for every product purchased, Thrive Cosmetics donates to help communities thrive. So every time you use your favorite Thrive Cosmetics product, you're helping communities you care about too. Amplify your everyday. Go to thrivecosmetics.com/shine26 for an exclusive offer of 20% off your first order. That's Thrive Cosmetics, CAUSEMETICS.com/shine26.
December 23rd, 1975. A bitter winter morning settles over the quiet college town of Normal, Illinois. Christmas is only 2 days away. Most students have already left Illinois State University for the holidays. The campus is nearly empty. A passerby walking near the sorority house on Fell Avenue hears something unusual. A faint sound, almost like someone struggling to breathe. At first, the person assumes it's nothing. But the sound comes again. They walk closer to the side of Delta Zeta sorority house. And then, they see her. A young woman lying motionless in the frozen grass. Her coat pulled partly over her body. Blood frozen into the ground beneath her head. She'd been there all night. Unconscious. Dying. Just steps away from the front door of her own home. Her name was Carol Ann Rothstad, and nearly 50 years later, her killer has never been caught. This is American Dread, a true story of tragedy and terror from the dark side of American heartland. I'm your host, Adam White. American Dread is part of the American Hauntings Podcast Network. Today's story takes us back to a quiet Midwestern college town and a brutal murder that shocked the community just days before Christmas, a crime that remains unsolved nearly a half a century later. This is the story of Carol Ann Rothstad. Carol Rothstad was a 21-year-old Illinois State University student, a psychologist major, and she was from a suburb of Elk Grove Village, Illinois. She was attacked outside the Delta Zeta sorority house on South Fell Street on December 22, 1975, and died 2 days later on Christmas Eve. That is a simple version, but cases like this are never simple. Because before Carol became a headline, before she became a cold case, before her name became attached to questions and theories, she was just a young woman trying to build her life, a college student, a daughter, a sister, a friend, someone with classes to finish, holidays ahead of her, and a future that should have stretched decades beyond that winter. Instead, her name became part of the landscape of fear, and in a college town, fear spreads fast, especially when it feels like a killer may still be nearby. Normal and Bloomington in the mid-1970s carried the reputation of a lot of Midwestern college towns carried. Steady, manageable, safer than the big cities. Students, churches, diners, railroad tracks, bars, old neighborhoods, and campus buildings set close enough together that people got used to the idea that everything important was nearby. But across the country, the 1970s were not safe years. According to the Bureau of Justice statistics summaries, the national homicide rate doubled from the mid-1960s to the late 1970s. Before peaking at 10.2 per 100,000 in 1980. Another statistic found that 5.8% of U.S. households had at least one family member who was a victim of violent crime in 1975. And under the FBI's Uniform Crime Reporting Program, violent crime was defined through four major categories: murder, manslaughter, rape, robbery, aggravated assault. That matters here, because when we look back at Carol's case, we are not looking at the murder in a vacuum. We are looking at a murder in an era when violent crime was surging, women were being told to be careful without always being protected, and campuses still operated with false sense of security. Doors were left open, houses felt safe because they were familiar, and people who preyed on that trust had room to move. And this is where Carol's story turns from tragic to terrifying, because the murder may not have been the beginning. According to newspaper coverage, Carol herself was attacked before she was killed. In July of 1974, more than a year before her murder, a man reportedly broke into the Delta Zeta house at 602 South Fell around 3 a.m. by breaking a window in the back door. The intruder allegedly cut the telephone line on the first floor, went upstairs into Carol's bedroom, put a hand to her throat, covered her mouth, lifted her from the bed, threw her against a chest of drawers, and then ran. Carol survived that attack, but the details are chilling. A nighttime intruder, a sorority house, a woman asleep in her room, a hand at the throat, a sudden assault in the dark, and then he was gone. 50 years later, 25 News reported that Carol's family and friends believe the killer may have been the same man who attacked her the previous summer. That does not prove it, but if that belief is right, then Carol was not randomly chosen on one terrible night. She may have been marked, watched, returned to. And that possibility makes this story much darker, because it suggests a predator who tested the grounds first. A man who learned the house, learned the routine, maybe even learned Carol. WGLT reported that she was last seen walking home on December 22nd, and that she was later found around noon on December 23rd after being badly beaten. That is the part we can stand on. The rest is what makes the case so haunting, because there is a stretch of time, a short stretch, but a fatal one, where Carol disappeared into the darkness. Not gone for days, not missing for weeks, just one walk, one final approach home, one small piece of time where somebody stepped in. Think about how frightening that is. She was not deep in the countryside. She was not isolated on some deserted highway. She was right there, near home, near safety, near the door she should have reached. Somewhere in those final moments, someone attacked her with a piece of wood, perhaps part of a railroad tie. Authorities have consistently described the weapon that way, and WGLT reported that an 18-inch railroad tie covered in blood was found near her. The violence was extreme. This was not a shove, not a struggle that got out of hand. Carol was beaten in the head so badly that when she was later found, she was unconscious and near death. And then the attacker left her there, outside, in the cold, all night. This is one of the cruelest parts of the case. Carol was not found immediately. WGLT reported she was found around noon on December 23rd, after being attacked the night before. That means she lay outside throughout the night, in December, in Illinois, in the darkness and in the cold. In pain, no one can measure now. And all the while, the sorority house stood only feet away. The warmth inside, the lights, the ordinary life of a house that, at least for a few more hours, did not yet know that the horror was laying just outside. Cases like this stay with people because of details like that. Not just the murder itself, but the terrible nearness of rescue. The fact that safety was right there, and still, somehow, out of reach. When Carol was found, she was still alive. She was taken to a hospital, but the injuries were grave. 25 News reported she died in the hospital 2 days later on Christmas Eve. Christmas Eve, that date matters, because it freezes the case in time. Other families were opening gifts, cooking dinners, gathering together. Carol's family was losing her. And from that point on, every Christmas season would carry that memory with it. Not just celebration, but the anniversary of a killing. That is one reason cold cases endure so fiercely in families and towns. They attach themselves to seasons, to holidays, to weather, to songs on the radio, and they never really let go. Once word spread, fear rippled through the campus community, and the reason is obvious. Carol was not killed in some far-off part of town. She was attacked outside her sorority house. That hits differently. A murder near a home tells every student the same thing. You're not as safe as you thought. Because Carol's death did not sit alone in a neat little box. It existed beside other attacks on women, other intruders, other late-night terrors, other moments where a bedroom, a walkway, a sorority house, or a campus street became the stage for violence. Newspaper clippings from April of 1977 show just how serious police and local newspapers were considering a pattern. One article reported that detectives were looking into whether attacks on co-eds at Illinois State and IWU could be connected to Carol's murder. Another article described one woman being attacked at IWU's sorority house by a man who put his hand over her throat and her mouth. Another described an ISU woman confronted by an intruder in a room, a flashlight in her face, a threat to keep quiet, and then a struggle at the stairs. And there was another report of a 24-year-old ISU co-ed who was raped within days of these cases, aimed at growing concern about attacks on women in Bloomington Normal. All these articles show something investigators wrestled with in real time. Some descriptions seem similar. Some were too vague, and police were cautious about saying the crimes were linked. But whether they were the same offender or not, the atmosphere around campus had changed. Women were being attacked, sorority houses were being entered, dormitories were no longer being treated as automatically safe, and Carol's murder hung over all of it like a shadow. That is critical to this story. Because even if every one of those cases was not committed by the same man, the fear was real. The vulnerability was real. And the possibility of a prowler, a stalker, a repeat intruder was real enough that the newspapers kept asking the question, was Carol's killer still out there?
This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. We're taking a moment to celebrate women and all that they carry. At work, in relationships, in families, and in the many roles they hold every day. Women have played a strong role in my life. I was raised by a single mother. She worked multiple jobs at once, and I can't imagine how difficult I was to deal with as a child. But somehow, my mom and a village made it work. I'm sure some of our listeners can also think of someone like that in their own lives. Often the strongest people in our lives are usually the ones holding everything together. Which also means they are the last ones to get support themselves, or who might need someone to talk to the most. And that's where BetterHelp comes in. BetterHelp has quality therapists who work according to a strict code of conduct and are fully licensed in the U.S. BetterHelp does the initial matching work for you so you can focus on your therapy goals. A short questionnaire helps identify your needs and preferences, and their 12-plus years of experience and industry-leading match fulfillment rate means they typically get it right the first time. And if you're not happy with your match, you can switch to a different therapist at any time from their tailored recommendations. They also have great client reviews. With over 30,000 therapists, BetterHelp is the world's largest online therapy program, having served over 6 million people globally, and it works, with an average rating of 4.9 out of 5 for a live session based on over 1.7 million client reviews. Your emotional well-being matters. Find support and feel lighter in therapy. Sign up and get 10% off at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.
We all are buying supplements, taking vitamins, and following the latest workout trends. But what if the newest tip from your favorite health influencer isn't actually what your body needs? True Diagnostic helps you find out the exact supplements and lifestyle changes that can make a difference and which ones might just be wasting your money. If you're spending money on supplements, workouts, and wellness trends, it's worth knowing what is actually moving the needle for you. That's where True Diagnostic comes in. My at-home test was simple. The instructions were clear and easy to follow, and it came with a prepaid envelope, which made it convenient to send back because I don't have any stamps. I'm super stoked to receive my results in the next 2 to 4 weeks so I can dial in exactly what needs to be changed to improve longevity and health markers. Because I have plans for this podcast, so I gotta be in tip-top shape, and True Diagnostic is helping me get started. One of the tests True Diagnostic offers that I've taken is called True Health, which measures your current health. It tests over 105 biomarkers, including vitamins, minerals, antioxidants, and fatty acids to understand systems health right now. It focuses on energy, metabolism, inflammation, and nutrient status today. And it provides your top three health actions for the next 90 days. You can get even more info if you opt in for the combo kit, which includes the True Health Test and the True Age Test, which reports on longevity and aging. The experience and process is so simple that even Troy and I were able to figure it out. You order online and the kit ships right to your door. It's a quick single finger prick at home, then you drop it in the prepaid return package. You can get digital results with an easy to follow 90-day plan in your inbox. Your only job, follow the three most important actions you can take for 90 days, then retest to see your progress. You can get a one-time kit just to get a baseline of where your body's at currently, or a subscription to measure progress over time. Also, True Diagnostic is trusted by top longevity clinics and health professionals, not just consumers at home. Right now, our listeners can get 20% off at TrueDiagnostic.com using code HAUNTINGS at checkout. That's TrueDiagnostic.com and use code HAUNTINGS for 20% off today. Choose True Age, True Health, or the Combo Kit as a one-time purchase or subscription.
Officially, the core facts remain straightforward. Carol was attacked outside her sorority house on December 22, 1975. She was a 21-year-old psychologist major from Elk Grove Village. She died 2 days later on Christmas Eve. And the weapon was believed to be a piece of wood, perhaps part of a railroad tie. But cold cases are built on what does not happen as much as what does. The arrest that never comes, the witnesses who never speak, the evidence that sits too long, the interview that goes nowhere, the lead that is not followed far enough. WGLT News reported that advocates who later reviewed the file were struck by how many suspects were apparently handled through polygraphs and then moved aside if they passed. WGLT News also reported that the renowned public interest in the case was driven by the request for police files in hopes that forensic genealogy might one day help solve it. The Normal Police Department says it's still re-examining the case, interviewing numerous people, and working with state and private labs in hopes that advances in forensic technology can clarify who was responsible. That tells you two things at once. First, the case is not forgotten. Second, the case is not finished. This is where the story gets especially frustrating, because the case sits at the fault line between old policing and modern science. In 1975, there was no DNA testing, no forensic genealogy, no digital case management, no easy way to compare trace evidence across state lines and decades with that kind of a speed we expect now. Time itself is a destroyer. Witness memories degrade, physical evidence changes. People move, die, lie, forget, or even convince themselves they never knew anything to begin with. This is the cruelty of cold cases. The killer ages with the case, and the truth gets harder to pin down. Now let's talk about the part people always circle back to. Suspects. Over the years, public advocates, podcasters, and people who reviewed the file have discussed several possible persons of interest. I'm not naming them here. No one was charged in Carol's murder, and it is important to keep the focus where it belongs, on the crime, the investigation, and the unanswered questions. But the categories matter, because they show the shape of suspicion that has always followed this case for decades. One publicly discussed figure was a campus political acquaintance, someone who allegedly knew Carol, had friction with her, and was later associated by advocates with violent behavior toward other women. That does not make him Carol's killer, but explains why his name has lingered around the case in public discussions. Another figure was a man tied to a drug and party house next door to Carol's sorority. That angle survives because of where he lived, who he knew, and the possibility that people in or around that house may have seen or heard more than they admitted. There's also the local troublemaker with drug ties and criminal history, someone later researchers believed moved through the same rough circles surrounding parts of the campus and town. Again, none of that proves guilt. None of that solves the case, but it does tell us something important. This was never a murder with no possible trail. It was a murder with too many shadows. too many rumors and too many people who may have known just enough to stay quiet. And in a town that size, in that air, silence can be protected as any disguise. Now let's step back and look at the behavior, not as gossip, but as pattern. If the same man attacked Carol in 1974 and killed her in 1975, then this was not an impulsive one-night crime. It was escalated. The first attack was intimate, physical, invasive, and terrifying. A bedroom intrusion, a hand to the throat, a woman taken by surprise in her sleep. That kind of attack often tells you that the offender is getting something from the fear itself. Power, access, control, the ability to enter women's private space and decide what happens next. Then if Carol's murder was committed by the same offender, the violence escalated sharply. From intrusion, to domination, to bludgeoning, from terrorizing, to annihilating. That is nightmare material, because it suggests a man who liked proximity. A man who did not just want to hurt, he wanted to invade. To appear where women believed they were the safest. Bedrooms, houses, campus housing, the walk home. That is why this case remains so unnerving. The scene is not some distant alley, it is the edge of a home. Some cold cases become history. This one still feels present. Part of that is because police still say they are working on it. Part of it is because advocates have refused to let Carol disappear. And part of it is because the facts are so stark and so personal. A 21-year-old student, a sorority house, a December night, a piece of wood, a body in the grass, an unsolved murder stretching across half a century. Local news reported that renewed attention from students and advocates has centered on the hope that modern DNA work could become the break that the original investigators never had. 25 News has likewise reported that normal police continue working with the labs as forensic technology evolves. That is the thread of hope here, because the killer may have gotten away with it in 1975, but science has changed. What seemed invisible then may not stay invisible forever. The real horror of Carol's case is not just that she was murdered. It is that she may have been warned by violence once before. It is that her death may have been part of a pattern that was only recognized after the damage was done. It is that setting was so ordinary. A sorority house, a college town, a walk home. And it is that the killer, if he lived nearby, studied nearby, drank nearby, or moved in some social circles, may have blended right back into the town after it was over. Maybe cleaned up and went to class. Maybe he sat in a bar and listened to people talk about the murder. Maybe he read the newspaper with everyone else. Maybe he watched the fear spread and said nothing. That possibility is what makes unsolved campus murder so uniquely chilling. The monster is not a legend. He is not a ghost. He is a man who may have looked normal enough to pass unnoticed in daylight. Carol Ann should have lived a long life. She should have graduated, built a career, grown older, told stories about college and Christmas breaks and sorority life and Central Illinois winters. Instead, she became one more name in the archive of the unsolved. One more young woman whose final walk still has no ending. But her case is not buried. It is still open. Police say they still are working on it. And after all these years, somebody out there still knows more than they've said. Somebody remembers the earlier attack. Somebody remembers the fear that spread around those campus houses. Somebody remembers a man whose behavior changed. A coat thrown away. A lie told too quickly. A detail only a killer should have known. And maybe that person has carried it for so long that silence has started to rot. Because the truth about Carol Rofstad did not disappear. It just got old. And old secrets have a way of cracking. This is American Dread, true stories of tragedy and terror from the dark side of American heartland. I'm your host, Adam White. American Dread is part of the American Hauntings Podcast Network. Someone out there still knows who killed Carol. And after nearly 50 years, the truth is still waiting in the dark.